Students, if there was one thing that you could know in advance about this school year, what would it be? Raise your hand. I want to hear it.
Graduate.
That you will graduate. Okay, that would be good to know. Yes, yes. Someone else? Don't be shy. It's something. Some of you are being prompted by the person next to you. Yes. What is one thing you would like to know about this school year? Yes, I see a hand. Okay. You have to keep it to this school year, all right? Yes, sir.
That I'll pass my flight instructor check ride.
That you will pass your flight instructor check ride. That sounds like a good thing to know. Now, if you knew that it wasn't going to happen, what would the year be like?
I'd still keep going.
You'd still keep going. This is a good man. That's right. Ladies, take note. Integrity. This is good. Yes. What else? What? One thing. One thing that you'd like to know. Uh-huh. I see a grad student over here looking very excited. Let's see. This should be very good. Tell us, sir. What is it? What's one thing you'd like to know in advance?
To know?
Yes.
Well, I'm going to pass.
Whether or not you're going past, I'm sensing a theme here. Is this like, are you all worried that you're not going to pass your class? You're going to do fine. This is Andrews, right? We'll help you. You'll do fine, right? But rest assured, yeah, this is going to be good. Nobody mentioned anything about like getting a date or something? What is this? This? No? Yeah, yes, sir?
Passing Greek.
Oh, here we go again. All right. Greek is not difficult. Hebrew, that's a challenge, okay? Greek is fine. It's not a problem at all. Yes, sir?
To test answers for my final exams.
To test out of your final exams?
No, just give me the answers.
Oh, just give you the answer. You would like... Oh, now, see, now we're moving forward, aren't we? To know the answers to your final exam ahead of time. Okay, all right. The entrepreneurial spirit runs strong here at Andrews. Yes, looking good. Wouldn't it be something to know in advance what the year held, right? Wouldn't it be great if you could make plans that you knew would ultimately not fail? Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if somebody asks you, well, would you like to know your future? Of course, you know, the negative stuff, we kind of like most of the time, well, let's just ignore that. If you could snap your fingers and know the good things that are out there, and let me qualify it even more, the right things. Not just the things that maybe we imagine might bring us happiness, but that actually would bring the joy of the Lord into our lives. What if we could know the plans that God has for us? Wouldn't that be something? If you have a Bible or a device of some sort that has a Bible on it, Jeremiah 29, verse 11, please. Jeremiah 29, verse 11, it was read very ably just a few moments ago. Let's read it again. Jeremiah chapter 29. It's page 529 in the Red Pew Bible that's somewhere near where you're sitting right now. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11. My Bible, it says this, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." Boy, somebody should put that on a banner somewhere. This is overflowing with meaning, is it not? I think this is probably one of the more popular Old Testament passages that is memorized. You know, if you grew up, you know, going, for instance, to Adventist schools, or if you're in a Christian home and your family was part of memorizing things, oftentimes this one makes it into the brew because it is so powerful. Let's break it down piece by piece. Take a look at what's actually being said here, what God is saying. He begins and says, "For I know the plans I have for you." I know them. In other words, when God looks at you, he doesn't go, I'm not sure we can make much of this, you know, right? He doesn't do that. He knows. He knows the plans that he has for you. He doesn't have to do a survey of heaven to try to figure out what to do with you. No. He knows what it is that is best for you coming in the future. He knows the plans that he has for you. And notice also, secondly, that these plans are specifically for you. Now, since Hebrew was mentioned, biblical languages, let's be honest. In the Hebrew, this is plural. So God is saying, "I know the plans I have for you," meaning God's people, Israel, etc. But surely the God who knows the number of hairs on our heads can also know the plans for each one of us as an individual. Isn't that true? You're Paul in the New Testament. He's talking there on Mars Hill, and he quotes in Acts 17, verse 28. He says, "In him," meaning God, "in him we live and move and have our," what? "Our being." That's right. So in other words, the only reason anything is because God is, okay? And if God were to cease being, everything else would as well. All of the universe, well, let's just put it this way. At the risk of gross understatement, God is big. God is large. The entire universe exists because he is. And in a very real sense, God, moment by moment, keeps trillions, I mean, this is totally underestimated, trillions and trillions and trillions, gigabillions of things happening in the universe. God keeps them going all of the time. And yet, when God thinks of you, you have his undivided attention. Now, I don't know how that works. I don't know how you do that. God is not overwhelmed by the mere 8 billion beings that are on this planet. Okay? When you pray, he hears you as though you were the only one praying. You have his undivided attention. Now, this is astonishing. I mean, if somebody said to you, "Listen, I want you to engage completely with a million people," maybe you would laugh. "That's impossible." All right, so maybe 10. How about 10, right? Even 10 can be overwhelming for we humans. If it's the right person, even one can be overwhelming to us, right? Okay. But God sees all of this, all the moving parts of the universe, all the moving parts on this planet, and yet when you pray, you have his undivided attention. So when this same God says, "I know the plans I have for you," wow, that means something. You are the only one of you that's in existence. You are unique. God has put you together in this unique package of giftedness and passions and skills and all of these things. And only he knows what is best for you. He knows the plans he has for you, custom made, custom designed for you. But it gets even better. The text says these plans are to prosper you and not to what? Okay, not to harm you, all right? Now, how often can that be said about plans made on this planet? Right, you're on the campus of Andrews University, so we know there's lots of good things, good plans. Your teachers, contrary to what may have come back from our brief little session we had just a moment ago, your teachers want what's good for you. They have good plans for you, not to harm you, but to prosper you, okay? But there are also many, many, many plans out there that are intended to harm you, to fleece you, to manipulate you. And so when God says, "My plans are not to harm you, but to prosper you," that means something. God's plans are always, always, always for your benefit, never for your harm. There is nothing that God asks us to do that is not ultimately for our good. Every invitation, every duty he asks us to perform, every detail of every plan is all, among other good purposes, for us to be prospered. Now, to be clear, if we're honest, the reason we need to say this is because sometimes God's plans for us are hard. They are difficult. I mean, there's no other conclusion possible. If you've been alive longer than 10 seconds, you know this to be true. That Bible history is replete with examples of this. Daniel in the lion's den. That sounds difficult to me. Joseph, unjustly thrown into an Egyptian prison. That sounds difficult to me. How about Esther confronting the Persian king at the risk of her life? "And if I perish, I perish," she says. She did not know how the story was going to end. That sounds hard. And in my own life, and my guess is in many of yours, there have been numerous times when I wish God did not have such a high opinion of me. It's like God is looking and say, "Well, by my grace, Shane can handle this. I'm certain of it." I'm like, "Well, can we just talk for a moment? Can we compromise a little bit? Can we move the bar down just a hair?" Right. Sometimes God's plans for us are tough as nails. Don't be fooled into thinking that just because it's painful means it's not from God. That's not true. Sometimes pain is necessary, and the greatest growth can come from it if we're holding Jesus' hand along the way. The truth is that even in my own scrawny life, I have always found that God's plans for me, regardless of they being easy or difficult, do indeed prosper me and not harm me. And I believe the same can be found for you too. The verse ends with this. God says that he has plans to give us hope and a future. Now, it's almost like God is repeating himself here to make sure that we don't miss the point. Because hope and future, I mean, those things go hand in hand. If you don't believe that you have a desirable future, you have no hope, right? And hope, by definition, is future, right? We're hoping for something out there. And God says, hey, listen, guess what? My plans for you will give you that. It will give you hope and a future. Now, that's only going to get more important as we get closer to the end of time. I don't think anybody would argue against the idea that particularly today, one of the greatest needs of the human heart is hope. In fact, people without hope today often fall into despair and into depression. Some people that don't have hope, they become desperate, they become manipulative, they become violent. Other people without hope, they numb out. They turn to media or to pleasure, to drugs, alcohol, etc., in an attempt to forget their sense of hopelessness. And as I've shared from this platform before, perhaps one of the greatest segments of the population that is experiencing this depression and anxiety are young people today. COVID has not gone away completely in many ways. The anxiety and the depression left over from that still are very persistently continuing, and not just in this country, but around the world. Around the world, there are people that do not have a sense of hope, and millions, I pray not billions, but who knows these days, of people grope their way through the darkness with few dreams of anything that will make their destinies better. And perhaps even some of you sitting here right now put yourself into that category. You feel like this hopelessness is your story too. And if that's the case to you and to everyone who is experiencing that darkness, you need to know that God is here in this verse trumpeting at the top of his lungs. There is hope. I have plans for you, Jesus says. Plans not to harm you, but to help you, to make your life better. Plans that will make your life better, not worse, that will broaden the scope of your life, eliminating the mentally narrow, painful path that you're currently on. Plans that will establish you with strength in the present and give you solid hope for the future. This is God's promise to all that will accept it. And anyone who puts their trust in Jesus Christ, this is their birthright. We don't deserve it. But praise the Lord, God has given it to us. And it gets even better. And you think, well, Pastor Shane, that's the end of the verse. There's nothing more after that. That's the end. Good news. As it turns out, this text has a context. And the context is dynamite. Would you take a look, please, at Jeremiah 29, verse 1. Jeremiah 29, verse 1. Now again, verse 11 rightly is considered a famous text. Many people memorize it, etc., etc. It is our theme for this next coming school year. But the text is given in a context. There is a backstory here that provides, I think, only rocket fuel to seeing what God is seeking to do here with this promise. It's astonishing. Let's begin to get to unpack this here. Jeremiah 29, verse 1. This is the text of the letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders among the exiles and to the priests, the prophets, and all the other people Nebuchadnezzar had carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Now pause there, please. Even with that one verse, we now get a whole bunch more background of what's going on here. Jeremiah 29:11 is a small part of a much bigger letter that God is writing through the prophet Jeremiah. And we quickly see here that this is a time of great turmoil. The exiles that he is writing to are the ones that King Nebuchadnezzar came, 605 BC, comes storming into Palestine and takes the cream of the crop, you know, decimates the place, destroys all kinds of buildings, etc., burns things down, takes the cream of the crop, the nobility, the priesthood, etc., back to Babylon so that he can use them, and apparently a bunch of other miscellaneous people too, probably for slave labor. There is a remnant left behind in Jerusalem. And Jeremiah is seeking to function there. If we were to read even wider in the context, we would find that Jeremiah is he's in a terrible spot. The king is against him. Most people at that time were against him. Why? Because Jeremiah was saying things like, the fact the Babylonians overran us was a just judgment of God. For more than 100 years, we chose to rebel against God. For more than 100 years, God sent prophet after prophet after prophet saying, turn back, stop the temple prostitution, stop sacrificing your children in the flames, stop all of these pagan rituals and worship in my temple, etc., etc., etc. But Jeremiah said, as the voice of God to those people, you didn't listen. And finally, the only way to save you was to bring in the Babylonians and to have most of you taken off into captivity. And it is to those people in captivity, in exile, that Jeremiah is writing this letter, which includes verse 11 and a whole lot more. Now, let's take a look at verse 3, please. Verse 3. He, Jeremiah, entrusted the letter to Elasa, son of Shaphan, and Gemariah, son of Hilkiah, whom Zedekiah, king of Judah, sent to King Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. It said, pause again, please. This is fascinating. Jeremiah has all kinds of enemies in the king's court, and yet somehow, apparently, these two gentlemen are sympathetic to his cause. Now, keep in mind, this is dangerous stuff, because this letter is from God, from Yahweh, proclaiming things that the king, etc., others don't like, and Jeremiah is commanded to write it down and to entrust it secretly with these two emissaries that will now go to King Nebuchadnezzar and at some point along the way dish this thing off, this message, this letter off to the rest of the exiles. Now that alone adds a little color to the story. As it turns out, though, the crowd waiting to receive the letter, well, let's just put it this way. They were not unified. In fact, among the exiles in Babylon, okay, still with some elders and some priests, some well-respected leaders amongst the people, okay, amongst those, there were two groups, not one, but two. The first group of people believed what God had said through Jeremiah. God says, this is a just judgment on my part. You rebelled for over a century. This is the only way to save you. Be at peace in Babylon. Don't try to fight back. Settle down. Build houses. You're going to be here for a while. And reluctantly, perhaps, they believed and they repented and they began to live according to the ways of God. That's the first group. The second group does not feel the same way. This group did not believe that God had spoken to Israel through Jeremiah. They did not believe when Jeremiah said that God was disciplining the nation. They instead thought, well, this is kind of a fluke. This is a temporary setback. When Babylon came in and took over the place, well, you know, we were just caught off of our guard, etc. And now this group is being led by a handful of men to try to form a resistance against the Babylonians, possibly to overthrow them, but at the very least to gain the possibility of escape. Prophets and Kings puts it this way, page 442. She says, among the false teachers in Babylon were two men, their names we would later learn are Ahab and Zedekiah, who claimed to be holy, but whose lives were corrupt. Jeremiah had condemned the evil course of these men and had warned them of their danger. Angered by reproof, they sought to oppose the work of the true prophet, that's Jeremiah, by stirring up the people to discredit his words and to act contrary to the counsel of God in the matter of subjecting themselves to the king of Babylon. In other words, they were planning an insurrection. They were planning a rebellion, all while living immoral lives. Apparently, they were engaged in fairly high-profile adultery. And they were calling themselves to be true prophets of God, denouncing Jeremiah and leading the people down a path that would lead to potentially great bloodshed, making the Jewish community in Babylon a potential powder keg waiting for a match to be struck. Now, if you were going to write a letter to that brew, what would you say? Maybe try to smooth the waters, right? You know, talk about peace, perhaps, safety, right? Maybe you put some nuance and innuendo into your letter, so in case you know, immediately fell into the Babylonians' hands, they would kind of like not exactly know what you were saying. At the very least, I think most of us would avoid saying anything that might set off some internal rebellion, leading to still more shedding of the blood of God's people. Well, knowing a little bit more about the stakes involved, what does God say in his letter? Take a look at verse 10. We don't have time to read the entire letter, but let's read at least this little segment, verse 10. This is what the Lord says, quote, "For 70 years, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my gracious promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord. I will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord. And I will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile." You tell me, what is it called when the leftover residents of a nation you've recently conquered declare in detail that the captives you've only recently captured will be set free? What's that called? Yeah, it's an insurrection. It's defiance, right? For Israel to say to Babylon in this letter, I mean, you know, if the king of Babylon is reading this, you know, he may or may not care that this is supposedly from God, but he sees the plan. Hey, 70 years from now, a few generations from now, we're going to come and get all those exiles. Every last one of them is going back home. Ladies and gentlemen, this is defiance. This is in your face to the Babylonians. Why does God do this? And it gets even worse. For the two traitorous leaders, Ahab and Zedekiah, man, this is gold for them. This is gold for them. They can take this letter, as soon as it gets publicized amongst the Jewish exiles there, they can go to the Babylonians themselves, put the worst possible spin on it. Hey, you know that guy Jeremiah? Well, he's stirring up all these people. It's going to be a rebellion. Getting some good grease for the skids, you know, getting on the good side so that they can make their escape later on. Man, this could be used for so much evil. And knowing all of this, why does God instruct Jeremiah to send this potentially very troublesome letter? Wasn't one defeat enough? Why risk double trouble for his captive people? Logic allows for only one conclusion. God did it because when it came to the contents of his letter, there was no risk that his plans would fail. None. Zero. God had said it, and nothing could stand in the way of its fulfillment. Even if God lays out the details and the timeline of how it's going to happen and when it's going to happen, nothing could stop it from happening. So there was no risk. Which reminds me of a story. Some years ago, it was a Sunday morning. We were in the gymnasium, and some recent graduates of the institution I was working at had come back to campus for a visit. Now, I enjoyed this particular visit because a number of them were basketball players that had previously played there at the academy. One in particular, he's kind of shy, so I don't use his name. He knows I tell this story. I'm just going to call him Dave, okay? Dave was, he had played in the CCA and NCAA Division I as a university student. So he was a good player, better than I was by far. And I always like to play against players that are better than I am. I learn stuff, and it's just great fun, okay? So we get there, and at first there's not very many of us. There's only four of us in the gym. And we say, well, hey, while we're waiting for the other guys to show up, let's just do some two-on-two. And, of course, with my height and with Chris, with the people that were gathered there in the gym, I was chosen to guard Dave. Now, Dave is 6'6", and at that time, at least, was about 260 pounds. All muscle, mostly up here. And say, okay, no problem, you know, done this before, let's give it our best shot. So we start to play. And at some point in the game, Dave is out there beyond the three-point line. he is passed the ball, and he begins to drive in, and he does this little juke, this little fake move, and sadly, I went for it. My eyes are moved to the wrong place for just a moment, thinking he's going to dump it off probably to his friend, his cohort on the team. And I look this way, and he's coming fast, and I know in my mind, I really should just let him go. Because this is pickup ball. This is not game 7 of the NBA Finals, right? But I didn't do that. I went for it. And so I push over. He got a picture. He's coming this way. And I get in front of him, and I foul him hard, really hard. Okay, this is bad form for those of you that know basketball etiquette, right? I foul him really hard. You know, I get half my body in there, and I collide with him, my head slams into his shoulder. He kept going. He got by. He scored. And I'm checking my jaw, like, is it broken? You know, did I break something again? Is it dislocated? This kind of thing. And I don't just physically feel bad. In my basketball spirit, I feel bad because this is just bad form. So I go over to Dave and I say, Dave, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I should have just let you go. And Dave said, what? I said, I'm sorry. I fouled you pretty hard back there. I should have just let you go. He said, what? I explained. I said, well, yeah, I mean, you were driving for the hoop, and I blocked. It was a blocking foul. I got in front of you. I hit your shoulder. He says, your shoulder okay? And he says, yeah, my shoulder's fine. I said, well, I'm sorry I ran into you. And he smiled, nodded his head, and said, it's all right. I didn't notice. And he was serious. He was serious. It's fine. It's fine. Yeah, are you all right? Yeah, fine, fine. I didn't notice. Okay. Fine. Take that dynamic and multiply it by 10 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000. And you get a small glimpse of what it is like when somebody tries to stand in the way of God's plans. When God says that he is going to do something, he's going to do that. Okay? And when God says to you, I know the plans that I have for you, plans to give you hope and a future, plans to prosper you, not to harm you. If you trust in him, if you put your hand in his, and you're willing to go with Jesus, then all of that strength is now on your side. And even though there may be people that try to interpose themselves between you and Jesus and the goal that you're heading for, they may seem like they're in the way. They may seem like they're going to cause trouble. There may be some noise and some sweat sometimes. But Jesus is just going to kind of lower his shoulder a little bit, and heaven's freight train is going to go right on through. God's will in your life will be done if you will trust him, and there's nothing that can stop it. Now, this is not just my opinion. God himself talks about this. Isaiah, one of the near contemporaries of Jeremiah, had this to say. And it's actually God speaking through Jeremiah, first person here. Isaiah 46, 8 to 11. Remember this, God says. Keep it in mind. Take it to heart, you rebels. Remember the former things, those of long ago. I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is none like me. I make known the end from the beginning, from ancient times, what is still to come. I say, my purpose will stand, and I will do all that I please. What I have said, that I will bring about. What I have planned, that I will do. Amen. And that includes in your life as well. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a law of the universe. If you will trust Jesus, if you will seek his plans, he will reveal them to you. And if you will put your hand in his, then it doesn't matter what opposition comes your way or how difficult things are going to get. It doesn't matter if your peers are against you, if there are people plotting your demise. It doesn't matter what comes your way. Jesus will take you through. His plans for your life will come to pass. As we start a new school year, I want to invite you to commit to discovering what God's plans for your life are. In just a moment, I'm going to ask you to come up front here. We'll have Sharpies available for you. And I want you to sign your name on this year's theme banner. By signing this banner, you are saying to God, I believe your promise, God, that you do have plans for my life. I want your dreams for my destiny to become my dreams. And by your grace, Lord, and my digging, I want to discover what your plans for me are. That's what you'll be saying if you sign your name on this banner. You know, there's going to be numerous opportunities here at Pioneer, both during the week and on Sabbath mornings, to further that discovery process. In fact, I want you to know about something special that's coming to all of you that are part of our campus family, Pioneer family, etc. Next week, we're going to begin to unpack the new seven-step strategy that we have here for Pioneer. The elders have been working on this countless hours. The board has voted this. It's time to roll things out. Come and join us next Sabbath. If you're listening to my voice right now, there is a place for you in that plan. I guarantee it. There's no one that needs to be left out, not at all. There is a place for every last one of you. I hope you will come and join us. We're going to start a three-part series on that new plan. And secondly, just for our students that are listening right now, we here at Pioneer, and I can speak for our wider campus as well, we understand that this is a joyous time, this is an exciting time, and it's a really important time. The decisions that you are making now will be ones that will impact you for the rest of your lives. Many of you have expressed to me in the short years that I've been here and even this year that that's a heavy weight on your shoulders. You feel it. You want to make the right plans. You want to make the right decisions. I want you to know that we here at Pioneer and at Andrews on this campus, we are committed to helping you do that well. Keep coming back. Keep coming to be a part of our faith community here. We are going to intentionally seek to help you to follow the plans, to discover and to follow the plans that Jesus has for your life. Signing is easy. I'm going to invite you. We're going to do some singing. Abel and crew are going to come back up. We're going to do singing while we're signing this. To sign, if you would come down the center aisle, feel free to line it up down as far as we need to go. When you are done signing, you can pass your pen off to the next person and exit down any of the other aisles that are here. More than one person, of course, can sign. There's all kinds of real estate here. First Service did a good start. There's all kinds of room here to sign. Sign your name and remember as you do the words that are printed. For I know the plans I have for you. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. If you want to commit yourself to God and His plans in your life and the life of His church, then please come now and sign your name.